Welcome to the McCarthy Report, the podcast where I, Rich Lowry, discuss with Andy McCarthy the latest legal and national security issues. This week, what else? The drama over the Trump bond in New York. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And please give this podcast an Andy McCarthy, the glowing, indeed gushing, five-star reviews that they deserve on iTunes. And now, without further ado, I welcome to this very podcast, through the miracle of Riverside, none other than Andy McCarthy.
Hey, Rich, how are you?
Good, Andy. How are you?
I'm good. I think I'm going to be asking you for a transfer over to Capital Matters so I could become their
business.
The story I want to be all over is the Otani story.
Oh, yeah. So his translator was stealing stuff?
$4.5 million, apparently, to cover insurance debts. Wow. And everybody thinks about Otani signed this contract for what was like $700 million, maybe more than that. I can't remember exactly what the amount was. But he so cleverly negotiated it that they're thinking about changing the law in California because of him. Did you hear this?
Yeah, because he's evading a lot of the tax.
Yeah, so they structured it so even though it's like hundreds of millions of dollars, he's only taking $2 million a year for the 10 years. Mm-hmm. And then everything else is deferred. So the idea is he moves back to Japan and then they have to pay him. So California doesn't get, you know, its big slice of the deferred money, which is why they're...
What was this guy stealing?
I think somehow he had access to Otani's money. Now, his interpreter, so I imagine...
This wasn't like stealing equipment. Like there was some Yankee utility fielder who stole Yankee Derek Jeter's glove.
Oh yeah. You get that every now and then where like somebody who works in the clubhouse, pilfers stuff that they don't think anyone will miss. I wouldn't think you'd want to take Jeter's glove because they're crazy about their good. You know, there's certain things they're nuts about. But this guy, I imagine, he was like the all-purpose interpreter. So we only see him for like interviews after the game and stuff, but I guess Otani must have been using him for business purposes and other. And evidently the story is, we don't know what the facts are yet, but the story is that he somehow managed to pilfer like $4.5 million. And originally the story was that he borrowed it from Otani, who was unhappy with him for getting in the hole with gambling debt. And then all of a sudden the story changed to Otani didn't know anything about it. So it sounds like, embezzlement, if that's what happened. And everybody's clammed up. So it will be interesting to watch what happens. But, you know, for Otani, who's obviously a careful guy, I mean, to negotiate a contract like that and only take $2 million a year when he could have taken much more so he could beat them on taxes – it's got to hurt to lose $4.5 million because you're asleep at the switch. But so we'll see.
All right. Well, maybe a whole episode next week on Otani and his interpreter. Megan will really look forward to that one. And
opening day, here it comes.
All right. So we got this Trump filing, and I actually read this filing, Andy. I've read it and scrolled through it multiple times for something I'm working on. But something I kind of skipped over a little bit because it's not of interest for me what I'm working on at the moment. But so why do these bonding companies, they explain why these bonding companies just have zero interest in doing this for him?
Well, I think, Rich, that this is a lot of what the trial was about, right? Even if you accept that Trump grossly exaggerated the value of his assets, I think his pushback in the case is something that's not deniable, which is that there's a lot of leeway in what these fixed assets are worth. And, you know, depending on what you're talking about, like it's easy to figure out how much a shirt is worth in the store, right? Because they have price tags on them and people buy them. But with these mega assets, like, the Dodgers want to be sold, or
of course,
but you know, if it's something that size, if it's something like the size of Trump Tower or the like, and he's got a lot of those kinds of assets, you really don't know what something's worth until you sell it.
Yeah.
Right? And you figure out how much somebody's willing to pay for it. So a lot of this is judgment and estimation and all that jazz. And the thing is, you know, we have a case in New York now involving some real estate that's across the street from the library or the Museum of Art, or but anyway, the New York Post ran this story about how they got they estimated that the thing was worth $80 million and borrowed against it on that basis, and now it turns out it's probably worth closer to $20 million, and everybody is
I'm not a real estate maven, but I have the impression something will be priced at some outrageous level, and if there's one person who's like, okay, I'll do that, that's what it's worth. But if there's not that one person, it could be dropped by half, in a day.
Yeah, absolutely. So the thing is, if you're being asked, if you're flush enough and you're being asked to like write a bond for $1 million, you could probably take that risk if you're one of these big companies. But $500 million is real money, even to these guys. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to put their necks out unless they're satisfied that if Trump doesn't perform his end of it, and they have to end up paying the bond, that they're going to be able to execute on Trump's collateral, whatever he's put up. So they don't want assets that are of dubious or fluctuating value. You might hit a home run. You might have somebody post something that is worth considerably more than you realize. But most of the time, that seems to go the other direction. People say, oh, my house is worth, X. Mm-hmm. And then when the time comes, it's worth X minus a lot. Mm-hmm. So what these guys are like is, we need cash or cash equivalent, which means commercial paper that you can sell at a price that's, reasonably knowable. They don't want to take property, because as we've seen, especially in the post-COVID era in New York, property is not worth, especially real estate property is not worth in New York what it was worth 5 years ago, when it was a thriving business environment and everybody was going to work. Now we've had a bunch of years where people work from home, and some of these businesses realize they don't have to be in the office every single day, and suddenly the real estate isn't worth as much, right? So these guys don't want to bear that kind of risk. They want to make sure that if they're going to, if they're going to underwrite these bonds, that if it turns out that they have to pay, that they can recoup it from Trump. And it'd be one thing if Trump was looking at one single obligation, but before this thing with the Tish James case, where he's looking at a judgment that it was $355 million in disgorgement, but Judge Engoron ran the interest back to, I don't remember, it was 2017 or 2019, but with the interest that had already accumulated by the time he did the order in February, the verdict, it was up to $454 million. And it is accruing, because of the gigantic size of this judgment, it's accruing at $112,000 a day, every day he doesn't pay.
Yeah.
Right? So it's a lot of money. And in addition, he just had to post $91.6 million in the E. Jean Carroll case so that he could stop her from enforcing her judgment while he appeals that one. And I think we may have talked about this a week or two ago, but Forbes in 2021 did an assessment of Trump's upcoming big business transactions, mainly loans that he had coming due. And my recollection is he's got like three or four big loan agreements that mature this year worth about $250 million, which he either has to pay up or roll over, right? He's got to find a way to renegotiate them. So he'd be facing a crunch even if it weren't for the other little details in his life, which is he's running for president and he's looking at four criminal indictments, in any one of which he could get a prison sentence. So he's got a lot going on, and the bonding companies have to be satisfied that, you know, his condition is stable. And I don't know how many guys come in to talk to them where they ask, what are you going to be doing a year from now? And he says, well, I'll either be in the White House or in Leavenworth. Yeah. That hasn't been determined yet, but, you know, we'll see.
So let's
see how it goes, as Trump says.
About Trump's options, but just bracket it for 1 second to talk about something we were discussing before we started to record. Tisha James, you know, the rest of the lawfare, you know, you got Jack Smith is all caught up in the Supreme Court, and the timing is going to be difficult, you know, both in Florida and with the J6 case. Fani Willis has imploded, you know, and hanging on by fingernails in that case. Alvin Bragg may be going, right? But it's been a little delayed. But Tish James has totally delivered by picking up this, you know, piece of garbage that other offices are like, no, we can't do that. That's too much of a stretch. But she picked it up and with a pliant judge has slammed it home. And like, if nothing else happens, you know, if this case is dismissed tomorrow, which, you know, obviously it won't be, the humiliation that she's subjected Trump to just to this point, just having him to say, you know what, I can't pay up, this is impossible, and to have the real possibility dangling out there, you know, that she could seize his buildings, which she's sort of gleefully talked about that prospect in an interview. Wow. I mean, if you're a resistance type, Tish James is your hero.
Oh, yeah. She's – I mean, this has been – For somebody who's an ambitious politician like she is, this has just been the gift that keeps on giving. And she's got kind of I hate this whole lawfare thing, but I got to say, she's got a little bit of Trump-like moxie to her, which is, I think, driving Trump crazy. So she says, you know, every day I look out at that building at 40 Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Every day I look at that, you know, and it drives him. I think it just drives him nuts. But you can see the effect that it's had, because I think we would agree that the biggest dog's breakfast of the whole lawfare crusade is Bragg's case, right? Mm-hmm. The ridiculous Stormy Daniels case, which Bragg himself put the kibosh on a year before he brought it. And even in his office and in my old office, the U.S. Attorney's Office in Manhattan, which first had the case and had the Michael Cohen case, and was trying to make the big financial case against Trump and then decided not to make it or the campaign finance case. And then Cy Vance, Trump was like his white whale for years, right? He kept going up to the Supreme Court to get access to these records, thinking that was going to be the mother load of the big RICO case. And they brought Mark Pomerantz in to do it, the former mm-hmm. federal prosecutor. And it turned out that the financial records, they basically turned their nose up at it. They thought the case wasn't there. I mean, Pomerantz thought it was there, but others didn't. And Tish James picked that up and ran with it. And she got such plaudits in the Democratic circles, media circles, New York progressive circles in particular, that I think Bragg realized that in the front of the people he cares about, he looked terrible because he had declined to bring this case. Now, to be fair to Bragg, I don't know why I should be, but I'm going to be. He doesn't have this monstrous statute that Tish James has on the civil side, and she really exploited it to a fairly well. He doesn't have a manipulable fraud statute like that. But I think he was so embarrassed by her success and probably so jealous of his success that he turned around and figured for his own prospects, he better become the first prosecutor ever to indict Trump on a crime, even if it had to be something as stupid as the Stormy Daniels thing, because she was just getting too much good attention. So
she sort of precipitated that one indirectly as well. And if that one fails, her fingerprints aren't on it, right?
So, right, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Right. All right. Say, perfect crime, Andy.
Perfect crime. We need, you know what we need, Rich? We need two things. We need a statute and we need Arthur Engoron. That's what we need. And we can make it happen.
So what can Trump do here? There's a New York Post piece yesterday, we're recording Thursday here on, you know, maybe he could declare Chapter 11. That's something others have speculated on, but there was an insider, anonymous insider quoted saying, you know, he's been there, done that. He's not going to do that again. But the headline of this piece was that Trump could just say, you know what? I'm not posting the bond, and she can go ahead and try to collect her judgment and take Trump Tower, and we'll see how it goes, and I'll come roaring back and win a victory on appeal.
Yeah, it'll be Tisch Tower. Mm-hmm. It's coming. Well, you know, look, he could do that. I think the problem with that strategy is, you know, the government is not, whether it's state government or federal government, it's not meant to own and operate property. You know, the only reason that Tish James wants these properties, now she jokes about like how she's longing to be the owner of 40 Wall Street or Trump Tower or any of these places. But, you know, they're not business people. They're not going to run a building. You know, they could bring somebody in to run it for a while, but it's not what they're...
You could house migrants at 40 Wall Street.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's very lucrative, isn't it? But the thing is, they don't want to hold anything that's long enough or any longer than it takes to sell it. If they want the money. They don't want the headache of having to manage actual assets. The government's just not good at it. And what they really want is the money. And the problem with that is, if you're anxious to sell something, you're flirting with selling it at fire sale prices. And from Trump's perspective, you know, if he wanted to sell one of these assets, he would sell it when he was good and ready and when he could get the most for it. But if he has to let her take his assets, if that's the way he decides to play this, then she's going to get them and, you know, she's going to turn around and sell them.
Yeah. He's going to buy them back or?
Well, yeah, but the thing is, they won't be there by the time he's flush enough to buy them back. They'll already have been sold. And if she sells them for, you know, bargain basement prices, there's very little he can do about it.
Yeah.
So I don't know that strategy is – I mean, he's in a hard place right now, so you have to look at all the dire possibilities. But I sure wouldn't do that if I could.
The whole episode is bringing out a little bit of the Randian in me, although I'm not much of a Randian. But, you know, he built this stuff, right? And he exaggerated along the way, and everything was always the best and the beautiful, most beautiful, et cetera. But, I mean, these are serious – these are real buildings. You know, they're iconic in New York now. And for the state, you know, on the basis of this abuse, just to come in and take them, it's just astonishing and profoundly wrong.
I really can't believe that we're in this place. You could kind of – I think, Rich, you could understand this if – Tish James had been able to bring a case where she had like 100 victims who all had a sob story and had been taken for millions of dollars by Trump. Then you would say, well, okay, now there's a face on the fraud and there are people who are hurting because of what he did. And you could completely understand that you would need to post the judgment amount so the court could make sure before deciding your appeal that you were good for it, that you know, that you were going to pay what you owed. But that's not what happened here. What happened here is there are no victims to this. It's completely arbitrary. It's so arbitrary that in, what was it, September when or August or September when this thing was getting rolling as a trial, James said that her damages were $250 million. Then they try the case for 11 weeks, and then Engoron comes in at the end, and he says, well, you say 350, 370, I'm going to say 355. Like, there's no hard science or you know, hard, firmly fixed numbers that you could hang your hat on here.
So Andy, do you find convincing the a section of the Trump filing on this goes through, you know, that they're double counting this and misvaluing Mar-a-Lago by this much for this reason. Does that sort of stuff sound persuasive to you, that line of argument?
I have to say, with Trump's arguments now on this kind of stuff, I always feel like I have to see what the other side responds.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because they just, you know, we don't, you and I don't have all the facts, and they selectively mine them.
Yeah.
So, for example, the most, we should talk about this because this is the most famous example, and he keeps using it. So he keeps saying that Enguerrand valued Mar-a-Lago at $18 million when it's worth, you know, 30 times that.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, Enguerrand did not value Mar-a-Lago. Enguerrand relied on a valuation of Mar-a-Lago that was done, I think, down in Florida, but by somebody who assesses these things. And the valuation was, you know, Trump keeps saying 18 million. I think it was 18 to 27 million. That was the range. And what they explained at the time, and I can't evaluate this, I can just say what they said. What they say is, under Florida law, for these purposes, you don't evaluate a property on the basis of what it could yield if it was sold free and clear. You have to evaluate the property on the basis of whatever legal liens and rights have been surrendered by the property owner in order to get benefits. So as I understand it, like, Trump is very limited in how he can use Mar-a-Lago, and he agreed to those covenants in order to get big tax breaks from Florida. So we're not talking, when Enguerrand put that in one of his, I think it was his first ruling, he explained that this was a valuation of Mar-a-Lago with, in consideration of all of the legal restrictions that are on the use of it. Whereas when Trump says it's worth somewhere between $500 million and $1 billion, you know, he may be goosing that up, although it's a big window in any event. But what he's talking about is what Mar-a-Lago would be worth if you could sell it free and clear. So you're talking about apples and oranges. You know, they're talking about two different things. And it's a good talking point for Trump, because people do feel, and I think there's good reason for this, that this proceeding was rigged and he got railroaded here. And he's basically, they're putting him out of business. They're essentially using an atom bomb on somebody who jaywalked.
Right.
And you can't say he didn't do anything wrong. You're supposed to make a good faith effort to value these things. And there's a lot of evidence that he, you know, I mean, if you know your living space is 11,000 square feet and you're telling people it's 30,000 square feet, and, you know, if you're valuing it at $327 million when the record sale of a comparable property is like one quarter of that at the most, then, you know, you're playing games.
Yeah, that's the example that in the press comes up most, because it's easiest to understand.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's what, you know, I remember when I was a young lawyer, I had a case that involved selling narcotics within 1,000 feet of a school. And one of the defenses was that they hadn't accurately measured. So they couldn't, you know, you couldn't really tell whether it was within 1,000 feet. And the senior lawyer who was second seating me said, you have to give the jury an example so they realize how ridiculous that defense is. And what we ended up saying was, you think he missed this within 3 football fields?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you see the jury kind of nod their head, you know, because if you use numbers with people, it kind of washes over them, especially like if we're talking on a podcast or it's very hard to focus on that. But if you give them something concrete that's an image that's easily understandable, then you get them nodding their heads and understanding it. So I think that is the reason the Trump Tower triplex is the best example, because it's the easiest one to explain.
So let me hit you on another passage in the filing that I didn't know what to make of. They make a big deal of the statute of limitations and say that technically, right, these are transactions that were past the statute or have been time told or whatever the correct verbiage is. But since they were like re-upped or something, then Tish James has said, well, you know, the statute hasn't run because you know that this thing was, the loan was re-upped. I'm messing up the details.
But yeah.
They have a statute of limitations argument. Do you have any informed take on that?
Yeah. So this actually was a big issue at the beginning of the litigation. And my recollection is that the appellate division threw out some of the claims that New York wanted to make because they were time barred. And if you remember this, Rich, it goes back to when Cy Vance was trying to get these records from the Supreme Court. They were thinking that this was going to be the motherlode big financial crime case, right? And they ended up getting, if I'm remembering the, remember the big story in the New York Times, I want to say it was 2018, where they did a deep dive into the history of the Trump Organization, mainly going back to Trump's father, but, you know, how he took over and brought the business forward. So what we were talking about, my recollection is, it was like 40 years worth of records. And the thing is, the statutes of limitations in civil claims are often shorter than the standard statutes of limitations in criminal cases. And you can't sit on a claim forever. You usually, I think for a lot of it, I mean, I'm not a civil litigator, but for a lot of claims, you have to bring them within 2 years. Now, there's some rules, like, for example, in fraud cases, it might be 2 years from the time the fraud is discovered rather than when it's committed. So there were other ways they tweaked the statutes of limitations. But the bottom line is, a lot of the records that New York got were old, and a lot of the conduct went back more than a decade, and that stuff was all time barred. And the thing is, you have certain transactions that are known as straddle transactions. In the criminal law, we call them straddle offenses. And what it means is, like, part of the conduct is outside the statute of limitations and part of the conduct is inside. And that's why we call it a straddle. And the thing is, if you can't prove the newer conduct, the part that's inside the statute, then the old stuff is time barred. You can't, like, stitch a claim together by saying they continued beyond the statute of limitation to engage in the course of conduct. If the fact finder doesn't find that the conduct continued, then no matter how you've pled it, whether it's in a lawsuit or in an indictment, it's time barred. So I think there was a lot of conflict between the parties about the statute of limitations. And then the other thing, Rich, that went on, which confuses things and makes it harder to reconstruct, is at a certain point, there were negotiations between the Trump side and the state. And I believe the Trump side agreed to toll the statute of limitations while they were trying to settle the case. So there may have been extensions on that basis as well. And then the Trump people, my understanding is, then said that they hadn't told it, and the state said they had told it. So there's a lot to sort out. But they do have an issue with respect to some claims, and they lost, New York State lost some claims at the beginning because they were too old.
Okay. So let's move on. Before we do, just general political evaluation of Lawfare and where it stands. It seems to me this one might be it. If she succeeds in seizing his building, it might be kind of a tipping point in how people view these cases. That might be a bridge too far, but what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true because, you know, we've always – all of the discussion about the Lawfare campaign – until this point where Trump is facing these financial straits has been dominated by the criminal proceedings. And I think you and I have probably observed maybe 20 times that people's assessment of it will change or could change dramatically if he gets convicted. Like, all of this is kind of – I want to say it's – you know, it's kind of hard to assess what people think of it while it's just a bunch of accusations. You know, I mean, people have feelings about it. Like, on the one side, they say, well, this shows that Trump is a terrible guy. Look at all these allegations. And on the other side, they have the Trump people saying, well, it shows that they're after him. They're persecuting him to single him out, you know. And the conversation goes back and forth like that. But in a lot of people's sense, I think it doesn't become real until he actually gets convicted of something. Or on the other hand, like, he actually beats the case. Like, he gets into court and we throw down and he wins or he loses. If he gets convicted, and especially if he gets convicted and gets a prison sentence, I happen to think the Stormy Daniels case is ridiculous, so I don't know what people's response will be to that. But let's say he gets convicted in any one of these cases. I think that's going to change people's assessment of it. And it'll probably a conviction, if it looks like the trial was a fair trial, which, you know, we'll have to see how it plays out, conviction's really going to hurt Trump. On the other hand, I think if on the civil side, if she starts to seize his property and people start taking a hard look at this and say, wait a minute, like there were no victims here. Nobody got defrauded here. The state didn't get cheated out of tax revenue here. This is like they're making up a ruinous penalty for what is the not at all unusual behavior in New York of keeping different numbers for, you know, taxes and assessment purposes, for goosing up the value of your assets. You know, Trump may have exploited that practice. He certainly didn't invent it. And there's not, you're not going to be able to show any pattern of New York going after, particularly people who are like Democratic Party donors. You're not going to see anybody else who's been gone after like this. And I think it's one thing to do this to him. It's quite another thing if she starts taking his stuff. You know, and then I think they've really overplayed their hand.
Yeah. Okay. Let's pause. Let me do a quick plug for NR Plus digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. Your way around a metered paywall, your way if you sign up and log in to see about 90% fewer ads, especially the most obnoxious ads, will go away as if by magic. Plus, you can comment on articles and blog posts if that floats your boat and get invited to exclusive calls and events with our writers, editors, and other conservative figures. So it's a great deal all around. And this is the most important thing, a really valuable way to support our journalism. We need people to pay a little bit, not a lot, but a little bit for what they read at nationalreview.com. So if you're not already a member, please consider becoming one today, tomorrow, or the day after. So we got another libel suit. We got some more Trump legal. New aspect. New case.
New case.
Yes, in case we're getting bored with all the old cases. Trump is suing George Stephanopoulos for libel for this noteworthy interview he did with Nancy Bass, where he was very confrontational, said, you're a rape victim, and Trump's been found guilty of rape. How can you support him? And just would not let it go. And this got very, very testy. Emotional back and forth. Stephanopoulos is a real pro. At one point was licking his lips, which is a sign of nervousness, which just shows he thought maybe he'd stepped in it, but he never relented with Mace. And at one point she said, well, he wasn't found guilty of rape. She said a lot. It wasn't a criminal trial, wasn't a criminal trial, and he wasn't found guilty of rape. And he said, au contraire, look at this headline. I had this prepared because I knew you were going to say that. Judge says he was basically guilty of rape, although he wasn't found guilty of rape. So what do we make of this one?
Well, first of all, Stephanopoulos is a jerk. I mean, you know, of all people, Bill Clinton's enabler in connection with the, you know, the bimbo eruptions. I went back, by the way, and read a big piece that you had done in Politico, I want to say, you know, years ago about Hillary. This was during the 2016 campaign, about Hillary being an enabler. Yeah. And Stephanopoulos was up to his neck in that stuff.
You know who really nailed him on this was Megyn Kelly. Just did a fantastic video on
Yep. So, I mean, he, of all people to be, you know, he ought to sit this one out, really. And of course, he can't help himself. And look, we have to pay attention to this because when this interview first ran, Rich, the first thing I thought of was not that we'd be logging in a new Trump case this week. The first thing I thought of was, remember that preposterous question he asked Mitt Romney about, criminalizing birth control?
Oh, yeah.
Like back in 2000.
Or something.
Yeah. And Romney kept looking at him like, what are you talking about, George? Nobody's talking about doing that. What are you talking about?
Little did he know.
and little did he know that it became like a big theme of the Democrats in the 2012 election, that Republicans were not only, you know, coming for your reproductive health rights, but also, you know, they want to take away your birth control methods and medicinals and all that jazz. And I think the reason that occurred to me is like Stephanopoulos is a barometer for what Democrats are going to be doing in an election year.
You know, right? He's talking to Begala and Carville all the time. You know, it's a little bit like if you're talking to Karl Rove all the time between 2000 and 2008, you'd have an inkling of what they're going to emphasize and maybe, you know, do it publicly before they did, you know, and that's you're hitting on an example of that.
Yeah, and I think this goes to the question that you raised a few minutes ago, which is like, how is the public taking all this? So as you know, I've been a like Trump can't win guy from the beginning. And the reason is I've always thought this was a dynamic situation where they had a plan for what they were going to do as it got closer to the election. And what I think you're beginning to see is the implementation of that plan. You know, they're getting them. They're trying to get him convicted, but they've already gotten him found guilty. The fact that he knew Stephanopoulos did to turn to Judge Kaplan's findings immediately means they've thought this through and how they're going to frame this. And it's going to change people's views of Trump if they can make the narrative stick that he's a rapist, which is part of what they're thinking of.
Rapist,
And here's what Stephanopoulos is thinking and why I think, you know, look, he should apologize. He never will, of course, because he misstated this. And Stephanopoulos, you know, I think he's a partisan hack and a jerk. There's not a stupid bone in his body. He's very smart. And he did this with a plan. I'm convinced he did it with a plan. And he'll never apologize because it's just I think they're invested in this plan, but he should because he knowingly said this wrong. I mean, he said several times that Trump had been found liable for rape. And he said that two juries had found that. Now, it's not true that Trump was liable for rape, but as I will explain in a moment, Judge Kaplan has said that he was effectively found to have committed rape. And I'll explain that in a second. The other thing is Stephanopoulos again says that two juries found that. Only one jury made a finding with respect to the sexual aggression charge. That was the jury in the first trial. The second jury was explicitly told that that issue was off the table. So they didn't make a finding at all. And Trump wasn't allowed to defend himself on it because Judge Kaplan ruled that he forfeited his right to do that by not participating in the first trial, which settled that question as far as Kaplan's interpretation of the law was concerned. So it's not true to say that two juries made this finding, although, you know, I mean, if you read the fine print, the second jury calculated damages with respect to two claims of defamation that were predicated on a sexual assault claim. So, you know, he's at least in the ballpark, even though he's wrong when he says two juries so found. And if it was somebody else who was saying it, I would just think they were sloppy. I think with Stephanopoulos, he's not sloppy. He's doing this on purpose. But let me explain the rape thing, because that's the really important one. So in the first trial, Trump has been describing this verdict as if it was exculpatory of him, when the opposite is true. The jury was presented with three theories of sexual aggression, and they go in order of from most serious to least serious. They go from rape, sexual abuse, and forcible touching. And when I say the most serious to the least serious, as it's defined in New York law, rape includes sexual abuse and forcible touching. Sexual abuse includes forcible touching, right? So the thing is, the jury is told, start with rape, and then move your way down. But once you find one, you don't have to go. You don't have to go any further because you know the lesser ones are included in the greater offenses. So they look at rape and they decide not that it didn't happen, but that she hasn't proved it by a preponderance of the evidence. Now, that is not a conclusion that she's lying, and it's not a conclusion that it didn't happen. Then they move on to sexual abuse, and they find that that was proved. Now, as they're instructed, sexual abuse includes forcible touching, right? That's the reason they didn't have to move on to the forcible touching allegation. So here's the testimony that is relevant, and this is, and then I'll move on to what Judge Kaplan says about it. And you parents at home, cover the kids' ears. We'll give you a second to do that. So anyway, in her testimony, she says that there's a struggle between her and Trump in the dressing room at Bergdorf Goodman's, and she says in the struggle, she could feel his hands moving around, and then she was penetrated. And she said she didn't know. She thought that it was digitally, but she wasn't sure. And the assault, as she described it, never came to a sexual climax because she got him off her. Mm-hmm. As a result, there's no like evidence of a sex organ's involvement. And yes, she's not exactly.
Just for being so graphic, was he on top of her? Were they prone on the ground?
They were kind of she's leaning with her back against a wall, and I think there's like a bench of some kind on the in the changing room, and he's like forcing himself on her. So anyway, so the testimony, this is an important point of law because in New York, rape is defined more narrowly than it is in other places. So under the definition of rape that they were dealing with, even though it was a case tried in federal court, this claim was initially filed in New York State Court and New York law applied. So New York has a more traditional definition of rape, which involves a sex organ and penetration. They found that that was not proved. However, they found sexual abuse, and her testimony about that is that she was digitally penetrated. She knew that that happened. So that's the finding. And then what Kaplan said is if you look at the more modern statutes that are followed by many states and the federal guidelines, they've changed the definition of rape so that if there's penetration by anything, not just you know, the traditional understanding of rape, then that's considered rape. So what Kaplan says is if you look at what the jury's verdict is and you understand what her testimony was, he's guilty of rape under, well, I shouldn't say guilty because that's a criminal law concept. He is liable for rape under the law of most jurisdictions in modern times because they had to have found some kind of penetration. So that's his point. And when Stephanopoulos is waiving the judge's ruling, that's what he's talking about. That Kaplan says, you know, Trump can run around and say, I wasn't found liable for rape all he wants. But the fact is he was found liable of sexual assault or sexual abuse. And functionally, that finding was the equivalent of rape in most jurisdictions. So he says that even though the jury made a statutory conclusion that that rape hadn't been proved, that under the now common understanding of rape, what she says Trump did, that the jury obviously bought her testimony. They found her a credible witness. Otherwise, we wouldn't be talking about this. That under the common understanding of rape, that's what he did was rape. Mm-hmm. So that was the judge's conclusion of it, and that's why the Democrats are led by George Stephanopoulos are running with that. So my point about this in the context of Trump's defamation case is he's got no defamation case. You know, I don't know why he brought this suit. You know, he's evidently running out of money. I don't think this is money well spent. but he's not going to win on a claim. First of all, he's a public figure, but Stephanopoulos has plenty to work with in terms of why he used the term rape if he wants to defend himself on that. So I just think, you know, this is a kind of a loser for Trump. And if he continues to make a big deal of it, all it's going to do is invite people to look at what the actual testimony and the actual finding was here. And I don't think that's helpful for him.
Yeah. So I imagine he just likes the idea of suing George Stephanopoulos.
I guess so. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, maybe he's got a better sense of how the politics will work on this than I do. But the reason that Trump is in the fix he's in is because he didn't contest the case.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not George Stephanopoulos' fault that Trump ran off at the mouth about this thing in every single forum except the one that mattered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he didn't take the short walk to the witness stand, take the oath, look the jury in the eye, and explain to them. And he's very compelling when he talks about this. I think he made a big, big mistake not participating in that trial and testifying because her case is weak.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that as I'm not trying to. I have no axe to grind with E. Jean Carroll. I don't know a thing about her other than, you know, what we've learned in the last couple of years. I'm not saying that she lied. I'm not saying that she's not a victim. She may very well be. I don't know. A lot of parts of her story don't make sense to me. But on the other hand, if I were Trump and if somebody was falsely accusing me of rape, you know, wild courses couldn't keep me away from the courtroom to defend myself. So none of this makes any sense to me. But when I say her case is weak, she made it, it's based on her testimony alone. It's pretty much uncorroborated. I mean, she's got a couple of contemporaneous reports, but there's no forensic evidence. There's no nothing. It's like 30 years old.
Yeah.
And if he had gone in and testified and done a good job, I don't think he'd be in the fix he's in now.
All right. So we're running a little long. So I'm just going to ask one question on each of these three things. And amazingly, slotted down in here in third is Fani Willis, our friend. It feels like ancient news now, given everything else that's going on. But we finally got the much-awaited ruling Friday after we had recorded, and it was a split-the-baby ruling where McAfee, is that his name?
Right.
The judge says, you know, this is not a real conflict. Like, the case wasn't brought in order to enrich Wade, and so you could take Willis on vacations. But, you know, there's an appearance here if they both stay on the case. So one of them has to go. And of course, Nathan Wade went and Fani Willis stays, but with a lot of damage in all sorts of ways, including in this ruling. You know, when the judge says there's an odor of deception or whatever the exact phrase there was. I mean, he's getting at the fact that they just lied. I mean, they lied under oath. And she's staying on the case for now.
Yeah, it's a nice touch. I mean, I didn't like McAfee's ruling because I didn't think it was rational. But the odor of mendacity line is from Tennessee Williams in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, so it is.
Yeah.
See, I didn't get the Tennessee Williams reference in your column about this.
Yeah, so yeah. That's where he got it from.
On me, I'm not a huge Tennessee Williams guy, and I guess it's showing.
Yeah, but I had to look it up, but I had heard, I knew I had read it someplace, and that's what it was. And I think if you're going to plagiarize, you plagiarize Tennessee Williams, right? Like, you know, I had an informant in the Blind Shake case who told me it was an old Arab or Egyptian expression that if you steal the moon, you know.
That's good. I'm going to write that one down. I like sayings like that.
So, you know, it's not a legally rational decision. I don't think his distinction between real conflict and appearance of conflict is very compelling. But the most important thing is, you know, the fact that he's talking about an odor of mendacity means that there's a continuing problem here. And the problem was created by the collusion of Fani Willis and Nathan Wade. And you can't erase it by getting rid of one and keeping the other. I think the political reality here is you got a judge who's looking at re-election, or not re-election. He's actually, I think, originally appointed by Governor Kemp, but he's up for election in November, and he's got to run for election in the same county that elected Fannie Willis, where she has a, you know, she has a strong political base, and these are low turnout elections. So I think he still may lose anyhow. You know, he may have thought by splitting the baby, as you say, that that he'd survive. But I imagine they're going to be pretty annoyed because he's basically he's destroyed her with this opinion. And it's now it's going to be a continuing case, Rich, because Trump is appealing. He's already said that. And I'm of two minds about that. I understand he wants delay. So he figures if he appeals, there's no way this case gets to trial before the election. And if he wins the election, he's going to argue that the state cases have to be basically frozen until he's out of office under the Supremacy Clause. So that's the argument he's going to be making. So in terms of delay, if he has to get permission from Judge McAfee to appeal prior to trial, I suspect McAfee will give it to him, and then the case will be off until after Election Day. So that's his strategy. As far as a legal strategy is concerned, if I were Trump, I would send a limo to Fannie's house every day so that she gets to work, mm-hmm. because she is the best thing he's got going for him in this case. Mm-hmm. And I don't think booting her off the case is a good move for him legally, because as long as she's in the case, she's now tarnished by this opinion. And this whole episode underscores that she's just not up to bringing a case of this complexity. Mm-hmm. So I think he's really – it would be bad for him actually to have Fannie Willis off this case, but I understand why he wants to delay it.
All right. And then we have Judge Cannon down in Florida, moving steadily south here geographically in our coverage of Trump legal stuff. And she's wrestling with this question of the Presidential Records Act, which Trump, you know, this is his argument. It's a three-word argument. Three-word argument. Presidential Records Act. That's what he'll say over and over again whenever this comes up. And she's grappling with this.
Yeah, and I think she's grappling in a serious way. It's a pretty interesting order, very short order that she issued last week, but she basically told the both parties to submit jury instructions and legal argument. I think it's interesting that she told them to give me jury instructions on this issue, because that really gets – when you're dealing with what a jury's going to be told in terms of the law that it must apply to the case, that's a really rubber meets the road kind of determination, as opposed to some of these legal arguments, which can get a little bit airy and abstract. So she's brought it down. I think this was clever on her part. She's brought it down to what are we going to tell the jury here about what the law is? And the question is really twofold. First, do we assume that Trump made a determination that the stuff he took was private records as opposed to presidential records, by virtue of the fact that he took it? In other words, there appears to be no written documentation where Trump made a determination that something was private versus presidential records. So we just infer that he made the determination by taking the stuff. So that's one thing. And then the second question is a jury or a court allowed to second guess the president when he makes a decision about whether something is public or private under the Presidential Records Act? So I think here's what she's wrestling with. You've got some case law that basically says when the president is president and he makes these determinations, they're unreviewable because there's no provision in the Presidential Records Act that allows someone else to do the reviewing until after the president is out of office. So what she's asking is, if Trump made this determination while he was still president, are we even allowed to look at this? Mm-hmm. And I think the answer to that is going to be the fact that the Presidential Records Act doesn't have a provision in it for this doesn't mean nobody can look at it. The Justice Department, for example, can look at it in terms of whether he violated a law like the Espionage Act, although Trump is arguing that that's vague. That's another issue. But the other thing is, I don't see how Trump gets to pick and choose what parts of the Presidential Records Act he's going to rely on. The Presidential Records Act directs that if the president makes even ceremonial determinations, but any substantial determination in his presidency, it's supposed to be recorded in writing. Mm-hmm. So I don't see how Trump can say the Presidential Records Act says you can't second guess me, but at the same time, he didn't comply with the Presidential Records Act requirement that he do a writing that says that I'm determining that this stuff is private, not presidential. So I think I still think he's going to lose this, but obviously Judge Cannon's taking it very seriously, and we'll see what she does.
All right. And then finally, our old friend Hunter, a friend of the show, I'm sure a devoted he, after making a big deal of wanting to testify publicly, passed on testifying publicly, understandably for all sorts of reasons, including they wanted to put him on a panel, including Tony Bobulinski, who really knocked the socks off of people with his testimony and had a really notable exchange with AOC.
Yeah. So if you listen to my financial advice on this very podcast, you too could end up just like Hunter. So bear that in mind. Yeah. You know, look, Hunter.
I have a father who's vice president.
Yes, that's the ticket. You know, look, Hunter has this coming because he very theatrically demanded this public hearing, right? I think it might not have happened if he hadn't demanded it. But then he got Comer's wheels turning. Jamie Comer, who's the head of the Oversight Committee and basically is the laboring oar on this investigation. And Comer decided, yeah, this will be a good public hearing. So instead of having just Hunter, he was going to have a panel and he's going to have Bobulinski on it. Bobulinski's like a loose cannon, but he's entertaining and he feels jilted. So you could tell he's like angry and he just wants everything. He thinks that he told everybody prior to the 2020 election that the Bidens were crooks and nobody would listen to him, that it was all suppressed, that the government suppressed it, and the FBI suppressed it. And now he's getting his moment in the sun and he's telling his story. So AOC, who is, you know, I mean, she may be a charming woman, I don't know. But she's kind of an idiot on a number of things that she chooses to bring up. And one of the things she asked was, you know, you haven't shown that the Bidens committed any crimes. And Bobulinski's like, how much time do I have? Mm-hmm. And he started to list crimes. And he says, well, first of all, there's RICO. And she goes, RICO's not a crime. It's a category. Which, I mean, I don't even know what the hell that means.
Yeah.
And I would think that most prominent Democrats would know that, for example, the guy they're running against, the right. former president of the United States, has been indicted in a RICO case for a couple of years. But anyway, so Tony rolled off like RICO. I don't know what the evidence that the Bidens committed RICO is, but it was certainly entertaining. I'm not saying that there's not a RICO case there. I don't know if there is or there isn't. I haven't like looked at it that way. I think it might be a closer case of RICO on the Biden family thing than on the Atlanta case against Trump. I was just going to say, I don't think the 19 people in Fulton County, I don't think they've ever done anything together other than get indicted.
Yeah.
Whereas like the Biden family, you know, in all seriousness, you know, they're an association. In fact, they generated money. They viewed themselves as an entity, as a brand, as they put it. And if you could show that they actually committed criminal offenses that were racketeering offenses, you'd be more on your way to proving a RICO than you would in the Fulton County case.
So final thing, Andy, is how adamant are you still that Trump can't win? Like on the editors, I often ask percentage odds Trump will win. And, you know, some are around 50 or a little above, some are below. But are you at a zero still given this?
Yeah, I don't think it's possible to be at a zero because then I'd just be being bullheaded. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think I properly calculated how unpopular Biden would be and how unfit for the job he would be. Mm-hmm. I really looked at this in terms of
you just relied on Biden too much.
Well, I still think that this is a disaster for Trump and it's going to get much worse. And I think that the Stephanopoulos thing that we talked about today is a sign of how it's going to get worse because they have a plan. Right. They're not like just going with the flow. They have a plan to make this much worse. Right. And I also think that you have to factor in, and we don't do this enough, the fact that the Democrats right now have gobs of money and Trump is really hurting. So the Democrats are now buying up all the ad time in the battleground states close to the election. That's a catastrophe for Trump. So I still think Trump is a decided underdog, but I can't say the chance is zero when it turns out that Biden is he's much more unpopular and much more unfit than I calculated.
Yeah. So to the point of Democrats having a plan, it just goes to they're not dumping Joe Biden. They're scheming and hoping and desperately working to get him over the top. And you could see at the State of the Union, those are not the beaming faces of people who are ready to dump this guy or have some secret plan to dump this guy. It was, you know, there are sighs of relief almost audible, you know, in the entire chamber because this is their guy, right? And it's either Biden or bust. So that's all the time we have this episode. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And thank you, Andy McCarthy.
Thanks, Rich.